So the title of this talk is The Veneration, or A Veneration of Discipline. Just as the ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so the Dharma Vinaya has but one taste, the taste of freedom. Just as the ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so the Dharma Vinaya has but one taste, the taste of freedom. So the phrase used in this oft-cited quotation of the Buddha is Dharma Vinaya. It's a phrase that the Buddha often used as a way of referring to his teachings. And those two words reflect two intertwined aspects of what the Buddha taught. Dharma, truth, teachings, his vision of the way things are, and Vinaya. Vinaya, what needs to be done in the light of the way things are. So Vinaya literally means something like to lead out from. It's similar in that way to the English word to educate. So it has the sense of training. In common Buddhist usage, the word Vinaya is often taken to mean the various rules and regulations followed by the monastic Sangha. And if we're not monks or nuns, we might think that Vinaya has little to do with us. But the monastic rules aren't really Vinaya itself. They're a particular means of Vinaya. Vinaya is the general principle of training or discipline. As such, it applies to anybody who aspires to follow the Buddha's teachings. So this is a really important point about the nature of what it is that we're about as Buddhists. What do we think we're doing? How in our own minds do we think about the nature of our practice? Well, from the Buddha's point of view, it's very clear. We're following a training, a discipline. As the Buddha's simile about the ocean makes clear, the purpose of that training is freedom. Specifically, this means freedom from the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance. So discipline, that's also, as Nibbaya said last night, that's a word with different kind of connotations. Sometimes it's used to mean punishment. To discipline someone is to punish them. But its true meaning is simply an instruction in training. That's the sort of root meaning of the word discipline. And a disciple is one who learns from in that way. So there's a bit of a paradox here that words like Vinaya, training, discipline, they imply being constrained, which is the opposite of freedom. We choose to do something that goes against our immediate wants or desires, and yet this leads to a deeper freedom. Now, I'm sure we've all got some experience of this, seeing it in others, if not in ourselves. To see the skill of a perfectly composed painting or an exquisitely played piece of music. You sort of see the effort and refinement that's gone into it. I think back to some particular examples where I've really appreciated the fruits of discipline in that way. For example, spending some time staring at a Rothko painting in a gallery. One of those apparently simple rectangles of colour. And yet being moved to tears by the sort of subtlety of yellows in there and just not knowing why. Another example, I was once listening to Catherine Tickell, who's a brilliant player of the Northumbrian pipes. And she was playing with such kind of exuberance and ease that I was very, very struck, if it's not too much of a cliche, that her mind, body, and the pipes and the music were completely fused into one thing. There was no player, no instrument, no music. There was just one thing. Another example, a memory from many years ago, was watching the athlete Steve Cram on television. So there was one particular race where he was well back in the field. I think with just a lap to go, he was still about seventh or something like that. And it's as if just at that moment, he just sort of flicked a switch and he began to just overtake one runner after another, after another, and after another. And he did so with complete, what seemed like effortless ease and grace. He was like a Rolls Royce sort of cruising past the rest of the field. And he won the gold medal by a clear 10 metres. So where do those moments come from? What is it that makes them beautiful? What touches us? I think is that we intuit. On one level, they look very simple. They look effortless. And yet we intuit the patience, the effort, and the years of refinement that have gone into the painting or music or sport. In the apparent effortlessness, we intuit effort and the transcendence of effort. I'm sure we've all got some experience of that in ourselves too. Learning to swim, mastering a profession, learning a skill, a language. In many ways, we've all tasted the fruit of training and discipline. Probably the best of what we are is the fruit of training and discipline in some form or other. Back in the 1970s, the Quaker writer Richard Foster wrote that superficiality is the curse of our age. Superficiality is the curse of our age. We live in a time when we expect quick results, easy gratification. Discipline isn't a fashionable word. In fact, that was back in the 1970s, in the pre-internet age. In the age of now, in the age of dwindling attention spans, we live even more in the expectation of easy results. As if clicking on like is the same as actually reading a novel, or having a friend, or attending a Buddhist centre. The world is suffering through superficiality. We're missing the deeper, truly transformative aspects of life. The title of the book I just quoted from is A Celebration of Discipline. And in it, Foster argues for spiritual discipline. The world needs deep people. And depth comes from discipline. So despite not being by temperament the most disciplined of people, this talk is aimed primarily at myself, I'm with him on this. Let's not be afraid of using words, those words, vinaya, training, discipline. But in doing so, let's also purify those words of any negative connotations. Let's liberate our practice from any sort of sense of drudgery or rule following or the mere application of willpower. So we probably know willpower on its own, mere willpower, doesn't really cut it. It doesn't really get us through. It doesn't take account of the depths and breadths of ourselves. It can leave us horribly alienated and split in different directions. So it's probably best to leave behind the word willpower. But we do very definitely need to think in terms of wholehearted commitment. And even that should be in the context of those other dhyana qualities of peace, enjoyment, interest, and energy. So that's what a Buddhist discipline, a Buddhist idea of discipline, might look like and feel like. Commitment, energy, also interest, enjoyment, and peace. So no doubt we've experienced this taste of freedom firsthand, perhaps in our very first steps on the Buddhist path. Perhaps through trying out meditation, we found ourselves in more open, liberated states of mind. I remember that in the weeks after taking up daily meditation, when I first went along to Newcastle Buddhist Centre, people remarked, friends remarked, that I just seemed happier and lighter. And they were right. It was a blessed relief even to begin to explore the more relaxed, positive states of mind that meditation brings. And as we continue on the path, our faith in training is confirmed by experience. That sense of freedom from old habits becomes stronger, becomes more well-established. We no longer need to question why we practice meditation, or ethics or Dharma reflection. They just become part of who we are. The fruits of practice also become part of us. But that's not all. A relative freedom from negative states of mind is precious enough. But as we take our practice yet deeper, perhaps we begin to glimpse a still deeper freedom. It's no longer about me or my states of mind. It's liberation into unbounded mind. Something rich, luminous, utterly without limits. Unbounded mind in which all one's energies cannot help but transform into limitless love and compassion. If our first explorations of the Dharma Vinaya give us a taste of freedom, then this is freedom itself. So whatever experience we have of liberation, we should never think that we know it. If we think that we understand freedom, our appetite for the spiritual life will be limited and dry. There's always more. Sangharakshita cautions us against thinking in terms of Buddhism as something that we can master. So in the Taste of Freedom, he says, when we understand a thing, when we really understand it or think we do, we become in some sense superior to that thing. Understanding means appropriating. It means taking the subject of one's knowledge into oneself, making it part of oneself, making it one's own. Thus we speak in terms of mastering a subject, mastering accountancy, or mastering mathematics. And so we speak, or at least think, or even half think, of mastering Buddhism. In this way, the idea we have that we might understand or master Buddhism precludes the possibility of looking up to it, of feeling towards Buddhism, towards the Dharma, any real devotion or reverence. In mastering the subject, we have completely misunderstood it. So that's interesting. We should think of the Dharma as a discipline, and yet not one that can be mastered, not one that we can become superior to. We can't master the Dharma in the way that we can master calculus or riding a bicycle. Thinking of it in those terms can lead us to a detached, merely mental dabbling in the Dharma Vinaya. We'll miss, as Sangharakshita puts it, the quiet revering of the unfathomable. So if in some quiet moment we've had some intimation of the vastness of freedom as an uncharted ocean on whose shore we stand, we might have found that experience awe-inspiring and perhaps overwhelming. sometimes our minds shy away from them or kind of ping back into more familiar ways of seeing and being. We are psychophysical beings, little self-referential complexes of mind, energy and matter, in which the delusion of separateness has arisen. And the forces binding us to that delusion are strong. What lies beyond is vast and unknown. This is our predicament. So we need to know what to do. We need a guide and a teaching. And fortunately, we're not alone. We've had the good fortune to come in contact with the Buddha and his teachings. In our community, we've come into contact with an effective way of practicing the Dharma in our times, and with Sangharakshita, a spiritual friend. The need for a sense of humble reverence towards the Dharma has been something Sangharakshita has always emphasised. He's paid particular attention, for example, to the Gaurava Sutta, in which the Buddha, recognising the painfulness of not having something or someone to revere, chooses to revere the Dharma. Gaurava means something like weighty respect or reverence. In What is the Dharma, Sangharakshita refers to a traditional list of six Gauravas, or objects of reverence. And one of these is Sikha Gaurava. Sikha is another word for training or discipline. So traditionally, these trainings, which are the trainings in the higher ethics, meditation and wisdom, these are Gauravas. These are something to revere. Sangharakshita suggests that any practice that helps us grow and develop can be spoken of, can be looked up to as a Gaurava. In fact, we need to bring a sense of Gaurava, of reverence, to every aspect of our practice. So let's look at this. Let's look at what our own attitude to our practice is, to the things that we do that make us Buddhists. So far, we've come across three very important things about what this attitude needs to be. So first, we need to see all of our practice as training, as discipline. That is to say, something that we do consciously and in a committed way. Let's not be afraid to think of what we're doing as discipline, in the best sense of the term, with commitment, energy, interest, enjoyment and peace. Secondly, it has to have the taste of freedom, not be mere drudgery or willpower. We need to actually taste the freedom. In every aspect of our practice, we need to stay in touch with how it liberates us. It actually helps to reflect on that, to enjoy the peace and freedom that comes from it. Make a point of enjoying the fruits of practice. And thirdly, we need an attitude of veneration, of humility. We need to remind ourselves that these are explorations of a vast, beautiful, unknown realm, a way in which something higher than ourselves becomes manifest. So with these points in mind, what I'd like to do is take a look at some of the actual things that we do that make up our Buddhist practice, particularly in the Triratna Buddhist community. Before we do so, I think it's worth noting that we don't have in the Triratna Buddhist community, we don't have a Vinaya in the traditional sense of rules and regulations. Or at least not very much of it. In a certain sense, that makes life easier as a Triratna Buddhist. You could just take it easy. No one's going to punish you for it. In another sense, though, it makes Buddhist life more challenging, not less. To practice the Dharma, we need to bring it down to specifics, to questions of what we do and don't do, day by day, hour by hour, moment by moment. If we don't have rules and regulations to tell us those kinds of specifics, it means that we have to work them out for ourselves, which means that we have to be constantly vigilant, thoughtful, conscious, attentive about what we're doing. This, it seems to me, is one of the great, great creative challenges about being a true Ratna Buddhist. What I'd like to do now is set out a list of some of the main disciplines that we practice in true Ratna. Over the course of the weekend, perhaps each of us can have a think about and perhaps talk with others about in groups how we relate to each area of our practice. Do we think of it as a discipline? Do we have a sense of liberation through it? Do we really look up to it? Do we venerate it? So the first five disciplines I'll talk about are the five precepts. So the discipline of loving kindness, the discipline of giving, the discipline of stillness, simplicity and contentment, the discipline of truthful communication, and the discipline of mindfulness. And then I'll talk about five more: the discipline of meditation, the discipline of Dharma reflection, the discipline of puja, the discipline of spiritual friendship, and finally the discipline of beauty. So let's have a look at each of these, just a couple of minutes each, just to touch on them. So first of all, the discipline of loving kindness. And this will include the discipline of, in its negative form, the discipline of not taking life. So what does it mean to see this as a discipline? Well, in specific terms, for example, there's being vegetarian or vegan as one way of doing this that many of us follow. I wonder whether we do have a sense of freedom in this. Does it actually give us a more positive connection with life, the life principle? It's easy to think of this practice just as a kind of self-denying abstention from meat or animal products. But in being vegetarian, we're actually bringing into being a world where animals aren't seen as meat or as beings to be exploited. A new kind of relationship between humans and other animals becomes possible. And that changes our relationship with life itself. So it's a sacred and beautiful practice. It'll do us no harm to remind ourselves of that. On the positive side of the precept, we could practice radical metta. So by this I mean the practice of metta with no ifs, no buts, in every situation, metta sutta style, whether you're standing, walking, cycling or shopping. Metta, metta, metta. If someone you love dearly does something to upset you, and your mind is turning round in circles of blame and recrimination, he did this, he shouldn't have done that, cut through it with metta. No ifs, no buts. Be determined, unshakable in metta. Never, take a pride in metta. Never let anyone or anything allow you to be shaken from your loving kindness. And if you're anxious, if you're in Tesco's and anxious to get what you need and other people are getting in your way, standing in the queue in front of you, metta. Your first and most important task in going into a shop, for example, is to practice metta. We can be conscious of that. Getting your tea and soya milk comes somewhere further down the list. No other practice I've known can cut through poisons like radical metta. I'm tempted to say that if you choose one practice to really focus on, I would go from this in my experience, go for this. So let's really revere the practice of metta, revere the Metta Sutta. It's a lifesaver, a blessed freedom. So the second one, the discipline of giving, which will include the discipline of not taking the not given. So recently, I've been on the receiving end of some real generosity at the Buddhist Centre in Newcastle. I've noticed the effects of this. My sense of what the centre is expands. It's not, after all, just a place that people come to once a week. I sometimes fear the evening class syndrome. But it is a real sangha. People coming together on the basis of what is deepest and most significant in their lives. So we live in a society that strongly emphasises the individual, or perhaps the individual family unit. That's the basic kind of economic building block. The whole industry of financial advice is based on the priority to maximise individual or household income. Every time we give, however, especially if we give substantially, we're building something greater than that. Community, sangha, is made up from lots of individual acts of giving. So it's a good thing to notice this. If you do give of your time or of your money, don't focus on what you've parted with. Focus instead on what's being built, perhaps invisibly, but being built. Relationship, community, trust. You can also focus on the relief of letting go a little bit of that tight, self-solidifying possessiveness we can so easily get into. So giving can be a discipline, a habit. It can just become part of what we do. It's a way of asserting that what we build in the world, what we leave behind in the world, relationships, trust, community, sangha, is more important, more sacred than our narrow, selfish sense of security. So thirdly, the discipline of stillness, simplicity and contentment, which will include the discipline of abstaining from sexual misconduct. In a Buddhist manifesto, Subhuti advocates something he calls sutra-style monasticism. In its fullest sense, this will include brahmacharya. Brahmacharya means not just abstention from sexual activity, but living life free of any kind of craving. It will also entail fewness of possessions, simplicity of lifestyle, careerlessness, that is to say, not treating your work as the main be-all and end-all of your life, and also communal living, or at least active participation in the Sangha through deep friendship. So again, this is a discipline that's moving very much against the tide of the times. I think we'd all benefit from reflecting on how well we are at least moving in that direction, moving against the tide. When we buy things, are we aware of our motivations? Am I just craving this, or is it something of genuine use or beauty? Do we make time and space in our lives free of distractions, free of the internet, free of mobile connectivity, free of all the stimulating images that the world throws at us nowadays? Not just on retreat, but also in the heart of everyday life. And do we make at least some time and space in our lives to be decisively free from sexual craving, physically and mentally? Is there a space where we can just let go of ingrained habits of perceiving people and relating to people sexually? When we're really aware of it, craving is a horrible, limiting, stiflingly narrow state of mind. So here again, we need to enjoy the freedom, the peace that comes from this practice. Not just dabble, but this, make this kind of beautiful discipline part of who we are. So fourthly, the discipline of truthful communication. And this will include the discipline of abstaining from untruthful communication. So in thinking about this, we can get into all sorts of tangles about this fourth precept, all sorts of knotty dilemmas and what-ifs. And it's easy to lose sight of the bigger principle. The bigger question is, am I inspired to live in honest relationship with others? That's what it's about. So imagine that, living in completely honest, open and kindly relationship with everyone around us. Family, friends, partners, the Sangha, the world in general. Does this ideal inspire us? Do we live up to it? If not, what gets in the way? Fear of conflict? Fear of disapproval? Fear of change? The precept of not telling lies is only half of this precept. It also means developing a positive habit, a positive discipline of saying what's true, saying what needs to be said with kindness in any situation. It's learning to find our voice as a truth teller. And that implies knowing what needs to be said, knowing how it needs to be said. No fudging, no unspoken collusion, no quiet complicity, and yet nothing but kindness. What comes to mind for me when I think about this is conversations I had, perhaps particularly in my kind of early days as a Buddhist, conversations with friends, spiritual friends. So there were those back then who were able to explore what was going on with me in my life with a kind of kind fearlessness. And I'll always be grateful for that. I don't know, in fact, where I'd be without them. So when I think of being a truth teller, of practicing the discipline of truthful communication, for me, that's what comes to mind, and it's what I'd like to work towards. Kind, fearless truth-telling. So, fifthly, the discipline of mindfulness, including the discipline of not taking substances that cloud the mind. So here we have one of the most central teachings of the Buddha. And as we know, after only a couple of generations, it's now become quite widespread and popular in the West. A lot of people are benefiting from mindfulness-based therapies, stress reduction and so on. Wonderful. But how do we practice it, those of us who aspire to practice the full breadth and depth of the Buddha's teachings? Well, let's go back to those three questions. Do we see it as a discipline? Something we do with conscious commitment? Does it have the taste of freedom? And do we have a sense of humble reverence towards it? So in this light, the discipline of mindfulness will be more than a technique we turn to resolve a particular difficulty. It's a teaching that we follow in all circumstances. And we practice it for the sake of spiritual freedom, to liberate us from that egocentric craving, ignorance and aversion. And it's really not an exercise with predefined outcomes. It's an exploration. Whenever I feel a bit low in my inspiration for practice, I come back to mindfulness, especially the kind of grounding of body awareness, and that sense of calm and integration was what first inspired me to take up Buddhist practice. Over time, I've come to see that there's much more to it than that. There's a connection, for example, between that grounded body awareness and the experience of beauty. Not just a kind of mentally apprehended beauty, but something more total, something an experience of beauty as interconnectedness, the kind of beauty you might experience in wild places, that seems to unfold in complete, the complete interconnectedness of everything. To really experience that kind of beauty, we need first to be grounded in the body. I think there's a lot more that could be said about the relationship between the body and those kinds of insights. Beauty is just the way I happen to think about it. The point is that mindfulness isn't just a technique. It's everything. It's a training higher than ourselves. It's beyond ourselves. In fact, in that list of Gauravas that I referred to earlier from What is the Dharma, mindfulness is listed as a Gaurava of its own, something worthy of reverence on its own, Appamada Gaurava. Mindfulness training is venerable. It's a gateway to the infinite. It needs to be an object of veneration. It's a Gaurava. So sixthly, the discipline of meditation. Couple of quotations. First from Padmasambhava, his words to Queen Nang Chuk. Again and yet again, work at whatever estranges you from meditation. Again and yet again, work at whatever estranges you from meditation. And a second quotation from the 7-point mind training. Transform adversity into the path of enlightenment. Transform adversity into the path of enlightenment. So these, it seems to me, say something about meditation as a discipline. If we want to, if we want our practice to really fathom the depths, to transform our whole beings, we need commitment. Dabbling, just meditating when we feel like it or when we can fit it around our schedule is only going to skim the surface. Sometimes we'll feel inspired to meditate, but sometimes it's more about grit than inspiration. Not that grit is just blind willpower. I think grit can also contain faith, and faith can take the form of grit, moments of kind of gritty commitment to practice, can even contain a kind of quality of enjoyment and peace at the same time. We don't always know how sitting down to meditate is going to help us with whatever obstacle we're facing. But there's a kind of determined enjoyment in finding out. Just do the practice, commit to the practice, and see. So this kind of commitment to meditation can only come if we do see meditation as something greater than ourselves. We need a sense of reverence, a sense of meditation as a sacred, mythic path, or a place of inner sanctuary that gives us the strength for the spiritual journey. So it's worth reflecting. How do we approach our meditation? Day by day, on the average Tuesday morning, what is it that we think we're doing? Do we have a sense of commitment to it, come what may? Are our expectations of it ordinary and mundane? Or do we have a sense of that sacred journey? So, seventhly, the discipline of Dharma reflection. So in The Art of Reflection, Ratnaguna suggests putting aside 10 minutes every day for deliberate, conscious reflection. Stop everything, turn off the phone, and reflect from a dharmic perspective. And carry on doing this until it becomes a habit. So one of the benefits of this is that we develop the capacity for sustained, purposeful thinking. Another is that the Dharma just becomes how we think. Our thought becomes Dharma. So what we can reflect on is our lives, a situation perhaps that we find ourselves in. And the framework of reflection will be some aspect of the Dharma. Perhaps it's one of the precepts, or a verse from the Dhammapada, or one of the Buddha's wisdom teachings, the law of karma and karma vipaka, for example, or one of the lakshanas, impermanence, emptiness of fixed self, unsatisfactoriness. You can also reflect on the person of the Buddha. Traditionally, if you reflect on the person of the Buddha, you just naturally begin to see like the Buddha and think like the Buddha and love like the Buddha. So we can reflect on difficulties that we might be facing, but we can also reflect from a positive point of view on how much we've received from others, on the good qualities of others or of ourselves. All of this implies that we understand the Dharma on a conceptual level in the first place, so formal Dharma study needs to be part of this too. But even that's of no use unless we actually reflect in a conscious, committed way, and with a sense of receptivity and reverence to the Dharma. So number 8, the discipline of puja. So puja means worship or honour or devotional attention. We often use the term to refer, of course, to particular practices such as the threefold or sevenfold pujas. But cultivating an attitude of devotion is much bigger than just the formal practice. I wonder if sometimes we get into a focused devotional attitude when doing a puja, only to kind of flip out of it when we leave the shrine room. Or perhaps it just fades out after an hour or two when the distractions of life start kicking in. This attitude of Gaurava, the attitude of worship, honour, devotional attention, as I've said, needs to suffuse all aspects of our practice. In formal puja, we're bathing ourselves in Gaurava, not in order to go back to business as usual, but to transform everything. So to perform puja is to place our whole practice, our whole life, at the feet of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. If we've really done this, it will perfume our whole life. So there are ways of reminding ourselves of that through small acts of puja, having Buddha images around, treating Dharma books with reverence, offering incense and so on. And what puja does for us individually also does for us collectively. Collective puja is vital in that it perfumes the Sangha with that attitude of humble devotion and receptivity. So the discipline of puja is not just the discipline of reciting the words. It's the discipline of living one's whole life at the feet of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So ninthly, the discipline of spiritual friendship. So what might it mean to regard our friendships as a discipline, as a training? Well, in a way, this is what we're doing in having such a thing as the Triratna Buddhist Order and community. Ordinations, Mitra ceremonies, Kalyana Mitra ceremonies, and so on. These are all ways of making spiritual friendships a discipline, a commitment, of regarding them as something higher, something to be marked and celebrated. But even friendships that aren't formally marked deserve to be regarded as a discipline, a conscious commitment. If they are a spiritual friendship, if they're a means of spiritual development, they take us to another place, as it were, as much as our meditation practice does, or our Dharma study. In fact, the Buddha didn't say of either of those that they're the whole of the spiritual life, but as we know, he did say that about spiritual friendship. So there's a simple question to reflect on. Do we revere our spiritual friendships, Are they a Gaurava for us? Are we committed to them as a practice in the same way that we might be committed to meditation? So finally, the discipline of beauty. Sangharakshita suggests that any true means of self-development can be held up as a Gaurava. Specifically, he mentions the arts. And as you'll probably know, the arts are one of the six traditional emphases of Triratna. For a lot of people, this is very important. But I suspect there's a lot of people for whom this comes a little bit further down the list. The arts are for arty people. Perhaps this is just about Bhante's personal interests. Well, we may or may not think of ourselves as arty or artists, but we all engage in culture. And some of that culture will be conducive to spiritual development, and some of it isn't. So there's a discipline here for all of us in choosing what we read, watch or listen to in the way of art, poetry, beauty and myth. Bhante has spoken of the spiritual life in terms of an ascent into beauty. And we can think of our opening into beauty as a discipline, not just a kind of adjunct to the spiritual life, but really that's what the spiritual life is. It's the very heart of the spiritual life. Our deepening appreciation of beauty, perhaps it will focus on the beauty of nature, or perhaps the beauty, the inner spiritual beauty of other people. In whichever case, we can think of ourselves as training in beauty, art, myth, poetry, spending time in nature, and so on, are the means of this training. And this opening into beauty, this ascent into beauty, is something worth honouring. It's a discipline that all of us need to follow. So, those were 10 disciplines, trainings or gauravas that we have in the Buddhist tradition and in Triratna in particular. It's not an exhaustive list, I'm sure you could add your own. But perhaps to make a conscious effort in all of these at once would be overloading ourselves. I don't think that's necessarily the way forward. It's certainly true that we do need to pay attention to all of them. But from time to time, perhaps what we need to do is to focus on one, create some positive habits, and then having done so, think about the others. Perhaps after some reflection and discussion, you might go away from this weekend inspired to focus on one or two of them. But before we even get down to that kind of detail, I think it's worth standing back just for a few moments, just to notice the breadth and depth of what we've inherited in the Triratna Buddhist community, from the Buddha, from the Buddhist tradition, from Sangharakshita. We've inherited this range of practices, this coherent system of training that really does liberate us from those narrow, selfish states of mind into an unbounded, rich, beautiful mind. If we take all of these on as disciplines, as trainings, which we commit to and are conscious about, that will shine through, or something will shine through us, something beyond words. And not only that, but we're part of a whole community, a whole band of people committed to these disciplines, to this path, together. And that, it seems to me, in itself, is worthy of celebration, of veneration, and of wholehearted, deep commitment.